You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, America. This is Pete Mackey, your host for a veteran story on AmericasWebRadio.com. My very special guest today is David Usick. David was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and attended the University of Stony Brook on a football scholarship. He eventually moved to Miami and became a 19-year veteran of the Aventura Police Department, working as a uniformed patrolman, undercover officer, and detective. David was awarded Officer of the Month on two separate occasions by his department and was recognized as Officer of the Month by the Dade County Chiefs Association. Due to a severe back injury, David retired from police work in 2018. During his service as a police officer, David befriended a homeless man named Richard J. Flaherty. Flaherty stood at 4 foot 9 inches tall, which theoretically qualified him as a dwarf, although the term dwarf is now considered offensive and insensitive by the vast majority of physicians. What transpired during David's friendship with Flaherty inspired him to write a book entitled The Giant Killer. On Monday of this week, his book became the bestseller on Amazon. David, my friend, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
You're more than welcome. All right, David, I want to give you enough time to relate this wonderful story about a man too short to serve his country in uniform, yet received special permission to do so. Therefore, the number of questions I ask will be very limited today. First of all, tell us about meeting Flaherty and your eventual friendship.
Well, let me back it up to the police academy. Actually, before I became a 19-year veteran in the city of Aventura, I actually worked for a year. Most people would never have heard of this town, the town of Surfside, but obviously it made a lot of news where there was that horrific building crash. I went, after working a year at Surfside, I was looking for a bigger police department, get a little bit more experience, and be able to do a little bit more in police work. So I transferred to a larger department, which was Aventura. And probably within that first year or two, I started running into this little man. At the time, I didn't know he was homeless. But I would work an off-duty job at the movie theater. They would pay us to stand there in uniform to keep the peace. And I would see him all the time. And you just couldn't miss him because, like you said, he was so small. He was 4'9", 97 pounds. But he did walk with an air of dignity and confidence that you just normally don't see. So you kind of keep that little message in your mind. There's something special about this guy. Probably after about a year of seeing him every day or almost every day, we started nodding to each other, saying hello. And then once or twice after a movie that maybe I wanted to see, I asked him about it. And it's kind of how a friendship grew. So we started running into Richard Flaherty more and more on the streets, and that's kind of when I assumed that he became homeless. And just to tell the story correctly, Richard always kept his appearance meticulous, his clothing, his hair. So he wasn't, you say homeless, but he really took care of himself. But when you start seeing a guy like that sitting on benches and, so early on, which was in the first few years of knowing him, I approached him about it, which is kind of a sensitive subject, and saying, hey, I kind of notice you're always out here. What can we do? What can we do to assist you? At no time did Richard ever talk to me about that he was a military vet. All he would just very politely say is, no, I'm fine. This is just kind of, I prefer, to live like this, and I don't want any help. So in Florida, we have a thing called the Baker Act, which if a person is a danger to themselves or to others or could potentially, harm themselves with just neglect, I have the right as a police officer to take them into custody and force them into a hospital. In my 15 years, Richard never met that criteria of being a Baker Act, where I felt he was a danger to himself or to others. So there wasn't much besides suggestions I could offer him. But, you know, he seemed like he really he had a good attitude, and our conversations were mostly about politics and world politics, and Richard really followed the news, and he was really always telling me about trends, and I bet you this country, you know, there's going to be a coup, or there's going to be a dictatorship, or he really had an amazing sense about the world and the way governments worked. So, you know, I always knew this guy was special, and he was very intelligent. It wasn't until the summer of 2015, me and Richard, we would start going for sandwiches and coffee during my shift. I would see him or I'd meet him. And summer of 2015, we were in a Subway sandwich shop, and he just turned to me one day and said, "Dave, it's time I tell you who I really am." Now, for those who never served as police officers, that's the scariest words you'll ever hear, is "I have to tell you who I really am," because, you know, we're a negative bunch. We're always thinking something really terrible is about to happen. And I had a lot of respect for the man at that point, too. I was very nervous. And he said, "Look, I was in the military, went to Vietnam, went back, got my went to Special Forces school, became a Green Beret, was decorated many times." And my first thoughts were, man, I feel sorry for this guy. Because here's my friend, here's somebody I like, somebody I respect, but he's so delusional that he's making up this story, because there is no such thing as, dwarves that are in the military. And medically speaking, you're right. You know, some people say the term is derogatory. They call themselves little people now. But due to a blood disorder that his mom had when he was born, he wasn't even supposed to survive. I think it shut down most of his growth hormones, and they knew, you know, as soon as he took his first breath that, you know, either he's going to have severe medical complications his whole life, and I don't think they even predicted he'd get past 4'7". So when he told me all these things, you know, I just felt bad. I mean, that was really honestly my first thought. I felt really bad, and I was just, you know, when we do deal with people with mental issues, you know, delusional, you don't break the delusion as long as they're not harming anyone. So I was like, "Well, Richard, that's great, man. It's just, you know, amazing story." And that was the way I ended it. So that night when I got home after my shift, you know, I almost didn't even think it was, what would be the point of even looking it up on the internet and seeing if there's any truth to his story. But something did, and I did, and lo and behold, there are these old newspaper articles from 1966, 1967, smallest man joins the army, smallest man wants his Green Beret, smallest man wins this, you know, award. And I was in shock. I really was. And the funny thing about Richard is he knew that I was just, you know, didn't believe him. So the next day when I saw him, he saw the big smile on my face, and he's like, "You didn't believe me, did you?" And I, you know, that was kind of how it started. So at that point in time, here was my thought process. I was thinking, this is the most incredible story on the face of the earth. Here is a man who, you know, went over incredible obstacles. The most inspirational thing that, you know, he had to get a waiver just to join the military. It took him years, and I think it was Senator Christopher Dodd from Connecticut that finally helped him, and they had to get a few generals to agree to even give him a chance, because they said, "Well, yeah, we'll give him a chance, but he's not even going to get out of basic, because how is a 90-pound man going to carry a 70-pound pack? How is he going to make it over walls that are built for taller people through basic? How is he going to do anything hand-to-hand fighting? So this is all an exercise in futility. We'll let him go in for a week, and he'll get, you know, rejected." Obviously, Richard surpassed all that and became an officer and eventually a Green Beret. But the plan was originally, when the next day when I ran into Richard, it was like, "Richard, I just want to know how America's most incredible, or maybe the smallest, America's smallest hero, how did you become homeless? Like, how do we stop this from ever happening again? And how do we tell your cautionary tale? And I told it to him in a very respectful way, not trying to make him feel bad about it. But, you know, I wanted to record it in some way. And I don't know if it was going to be a video or write something or a newspaper article. And I said, would you let me share your story with the world? And he said, yeah. You know, he made me promise him, give him three promises. The first one was, if we start the project, no matter what happens, you have to finish it. I said, yeah, of course. I'm, you know, to the, my best ability. What was number two? Number two was if this was ever made a feature film, Brad Pitt has to play him. And number three, he needs to get $1 million is his quote for using the movie. So that was the agreement.
I hate to interrupt you. We have to go to our first break. We'll come back with Flaherty's tragic death and then what happened with you after your best friend got killed. Folks, we'll be right back.
Whether cruising the strip in a 57 Chevy or taking the family on a vacation in a 71 Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser, you need to tune in to Classic Cars with Steve Ronaldo and Jim Weber every Saturday from 8 to 9 a.m. on americaswebradio.com.
Hello, my name is Rick White, and I'm the director of the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame. I want to encourage all Georgia veterans to consider being nominated to the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame. And if you are a Georgia veteran, then the definition of a Georgia veteran is either you were born in the state of Georgia, or you've lived here 10 years, or you were raised your right hand and joined the military in this state, you are considered a Georgia veteran. For further information, go to www.gmbhof.org, or you can contact me at 678-427-0915. We'd love to have your nomination for the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame. Thank you so much.
And adding to what Colonel Rick White said, if you haven't been to the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame, you've got to go. The other place you have to go is Johns Creek, Georgia, Newtown Park, where they have the wall that heals. That's the replica of the Vietnam Wall that's in Washington, D.C. This is the replica that traveled all over the United States. And now they also have the Afghanistan Monument. Mike Mazzell, Colonel Mike Mazzell, does a wonderful job at Newtown Park and keeping the memorial walk going. And just, it's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful afternoon to take. Please come to Johns Creek and honor our veterans. With that being said, you're listening to America's Web Radio and a veteran story with two very interesting veterans. With that, back to you, Pete.
Thank you, David. We're back with David Muzik, who penned a bestseller on the shortest soldier to ever serve in the United States military. David, please continue your story, sir.
So I made that unholy deal with Richard Flaherty that I would try to get his story out to the world. And the next 2 weeks, or about 10 days, me and Richard would meet every day, and I would take notes. And my thought at the time was not that really I was going to do it, but I was going to write up a synopsis, and I would find either a filmmaker or a real book writer to take over, because I'm just a regular cop. This is not something I have any experience with. So I would meet with Richard for every day, and we'd sit down, and I would question him about where were you at this time, and tell me about this part of your life, that part of your life. And just, you know, the important part of that 10 days is you kind of never think about time with people, and that some, you know, you think that you have all the time in the world, and I didn't with Richard, because unfortunately within 10 days, Richard was killed in a hit and run, and a strange one, and we can go into it, but I don't go too deep into the hit and run. It's tragic. It's disgusting. The person that did it was disgusting, and it's just so negative. I usually rather talk more about the positive and amazing things Richard did than give the person that killed him any airtime. But but after he was killed, I was pretty despondent. I was upset. I was angry. I was, and I just said, this is impossible. I only have notes and pieces, and how could I possibly tell this man's story? And I didn't want to tell the story. And I was just, I was in a bad way for a few months. And
I guess, David, that leads me to my second story, and that is, after his death, you researched his background and was shocked by what you found eventually. Shocked enough to pin a bestseller on the man in the service of his country. So I'm going to turn the floor over to you, sir. You're doing fine. Go ahead.
So when we initially, you know, when he was killed, it was initially a hit and run with a suspect that didn't turn himself in. So we were actively working this as a homicide. My department and a few of my traffic homicide investigators, and obviously I was assisting them because of my knowledge with Richard. I was the only one that knew Richard kept a storage locker, so that was the first place we went in our investigation. I had no idea what was inside there. I just knew he had one. You know, he told me a few times about it, and we located it. It was pretty close to our city, and the only way I could describe it is it was basically a treasure trove of Richard's entire life. So here I was saying it's impossible, I can't tell his life story, and here Richard left me every breadcrumb to tell his life story in a storage locker. And it was pretty amazing, all the documentation and names of friends and phone numbers and letters and things, you know, his thoughts and Vietnam and the woman he loved and the woman who's he's buried next to, which I'd like to talk about at some point, which is pretty important, on why he passed on being buried in Arlington's National Cemetery. But to get to the interesting stuff, what was shocking was I found Richard's passport, and Richard's passport showed that in the last 20 years, which is the time I knew him when he was homeless, he was traveling to some pretty interesting locations around the world. Cambodia, Thailand, Iraq, Venezuela, Amman, Jordan. Actually, he went to Puerto La Cruz, Venezuela on two separate occasions.
Huh.
So, I mean, that we went from the most incredible, inspirational American hero story to, you know, this is like a CIA movie now. Like, who is this guy? What was he doing? So everything kind of changed. You know, it took years, but people did start coming out that knew Richard, and they heard about my research, and they came forward, and there was one really incredible man that did. And he actually connected more with my dad. I think it was with age, and he was really conservative on, you know, giving out his information and giving out information about Richard. But he eventually sat down with my dad one day in California. And I didn't know that the guy he had stage 4 cancer at the time. And it kind of, if you want to put it as a deathbed confession, it wasn't a confession, but he wanted to tell about his friend Richard Flaherty and what he knew about secret operations. And that's when he opened the door. And I kind of had a feeling, talking to the other Special Forces guys, especially Richard served with the 3rd Special Forces Group, 46th Company out of Thailand. And initially, when you talk to the 46 Special Forces guys, the few that I have, including an amazing guy named Walt Yost that sadly passed, is their only mission there was to train the Thai Border Patrol, which, you know, it's just a little head-scratching that we're sending our best and trained Green Berets to train security forces, which later I found out that really wasn't the case. And then, you know, you have these amazing soldiers, these guys from MACV, SOG. You have the John Stryker Tilt Meyer coming out now, telling the country what really these men were doing and how brave and how dangerous. You know, these are the most dangerous missions there are, behind enemy lines with no support. So, you know, I started hearing a lot more about Richard working with the CIA in Thailand, and, you know, going fighting Burmese guerrillas and Malaysian guerrillas. So that's, like I said, this thing started taking a whole different turn from this incredible, you know, you have the first part of Richard's story, 101st Airborne paratrooper, you know, a platoon leader in Vietnam, recon platoon leader, solid leader, Guys loved him, wins the Silver Star, two Bronze Stars, two Purple Hearts in that first tour. I mean, it's, you know, the evaluations from his captains that served in country with him are just the most glowing, that he's just, you know, an amazing leader, and an amazing leader that he cared about his men, and he wasn't just barking orders or had the Napoleon complex. He led from the front. He put himself in harm's danger before any of his men. His only goal was to complete the mission and make sure his men came home. And we can go into a little later of how much damage for an officer not bringing all his men home does. You know, we're talking about vets and PTSD, and, you know, my God, the weight those officers feel when they don't bring all their men home, it is incredible.
David, let's do this, David. Start with basic training. What did he go through in basic training being 4'9"?
Yeah, so I believe he started out in Fort Jackson for basic training, South Carolina, probably October of 66. I spoke to two people that went to basic with him, and, you know, that first 2 weeks, you know, obviously everyone's kind of in shock. These are young 17, 18-year-old guys, and everyone's in shock, and everyone's just trying to figure out what's going on, and there really wasn't much personal attacks going on. But once everyone kind of was up to speed, then everyone was trying to sense who is the weak person that doesn't belong here, because obviously everyone knew they were going to Vietnam. So, yeah, Richard wasn't really looked upon too well, because a lot of the guys felt like, this guy can't hack it in Vietnam. He's too small. If I go down, how is he going to carry me? And this is ridiculous. This is embarrassing. So Richard was Richard told me once that, you know, he never started a fight, but he always threw the first punch if the fight started. So Richard was a little fighter. He was training in martial arts growing up. He didn't really play team sports, but martial arts was his thing. So he was already toughening himself up. It took a little while, but once he won the men over, and supposedly Richard was beyond athletic. The few people I talked to said, whatever we did push-ups-wise, Richard would double it. Whatever we did running-wise, Richard would go faster. So Richard was really, really athletic. I mean, later in life, when I ended up doing a documentary, I was looking for somebody super athletic, and I found a jockey, and he's exactly the same size as Richard, 4'9", and he was like a little tiny muscular guy, and I was looking at it, and I was like, now I get it. This is a perfectly, like a little tiny gymnast, perfectly athletic, you know, certainly body weight, you could just pick him up and throw him, but very, very athletic, very durable little guy, and certainly when it comes to endurance and push-ups and pull-ups, at that weight, they're little rabbits. They can go. So after basic, Richard went to Fort McClellan. He went to AIT, eventually OCS. I think OCS was in February of 67. After OCS, Airborne School, and then he went to Vietnam with the 101st in December of 67, which was just in time for Tet. You know, once he got there, I believe he was in Benoit in the south, and then as soon as Tet started, they flew them up to the 101st Airborne guys up towards the DMZ, and they were operating on the outskirts away. So I think while the Marines were in the city fighting it out, 101st Airborne was, you know, trying to restrain a enemy that is fleeing for their lives, because the Marines are kicking the crap out of them. Because the Marines, you know, were kicking the crap out of them in the city. The NVA were fleeing through the bridges, and, you know, the most dangerous thing is trying to contain a fleeing enemy. So I believe that's what the men of the 101st were doing. And, some of Richard's first battles and bloody battles were during that Tet Offensive.
Wow. And I know that he ended up getting the Silver Star. I think we'll talk about that when we come back. We're going to our second break. Folks, please stay with us. Fascinating story. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Rocky Blair, former four-time Super Bowl champion with the Pittsburgh Steelers and Vietnam veteran. As a board member, I'd like to talk to you about Warriors to Citizen, a nonprofit organization that helps American heroes soldiers, police, fire, EMT, and their families recover from the psychological harm caused by career-induced stress. Over the last 20 years, broken relationships have been a major causal factor for the highest documented divorce rate and resulting suicides in this population. This program, From Warrior to Citizen, is delivered free to families by professionals, all whom served in uniform and understand the needs to be addressed. I ask for your support. So please, go to our website, warriorstocitizen.org, and find out how you can help, either by making a donation or sharing this information with an American hero that you may know. And thank you.
If you live to serve and want to make an even bigger difference, consider joining the U.S. Army. With training in fields like medical care, linguistics, and engineering, an Army career can amplify your efforts with humanitarian opportunities all over the world. Plus, you'll receive competitive pay and incredible benefits, so you'll be taken care of, too. Learn more at GoArmy.com.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
All right, folks, we're back with David Muzik. He wrote a book on the shortest man that ever served the United States military. At 4'9", the man became a paratrooper. He went to officer candidate school, and he went to Vietnam, earned a Silver Star, came back and became a Green Beret. A fascinating story. David, tell us about the Silver Star he earned.
Yeah, so I actually just pulled it up, and I think the best thing I can do is just read it off. And excuse me if I get some of the names from Vietnam a little off. So for gallantry in action in the Republic of Vietnam on April 20th, 1968, Second Lieutenant Flaherty distinguished himself while serving as a platoon leader for Company C, 1st Battalion Airborne, 501st Infantry. Company C was involved in a combat operation in the Quang Dien District, Republic of Vietnam. At 11:40 hours, 2nd Lieutenant Flaherty's platoon, which was the lead platoon, was taken under intensive automatic weapons and RFC fire. 2nd Lieutenant Flaherty, realizing the seriousness of the contact, immediately maneuvered his platoon to deliver a flanking assault against the enemy's positions. Throughout the battle, he repeatedly exposed himself the hostile fire in order to better direct the suppressive fires of his squads. Lieutenant Flaherty immediately called a 90-millimeter recoilless rifle team to his position after having spotted an enemy bunker positioned to his front, which was delivering automatic weapons fire on his platoon. Lieutenant Flaherty then personally directed and assisted the 90-millimeter recoilless rifle team in an assault of the enemy bunker. Braving the intense hail of hostile fire, under Lieutenant Flaherty's astute direction and leadership, the enemy bunker was swiftly destroyed, enabling his platoon to advance and continue its devastating attack against the enemy. Second Lieutenant Flaherty's extraordinary heroism while engaged in close combat with a well-dug-in enemy force was in keeping with the highest traditions of the military service and reflects great credit upon himself, his team, and the United States Army, by direction of the President of the United States under the provision of the Act of Congress established July 9th, 1918.
Wow. Did he tell you anything about the action that day?
We talked briefly about it. He told me some of the things that happened, that when he took off, when he spotted the enemy bunker, he told me that he tried to direct the fire to him, and he found a large tree, and he ran to it and to try to pull the bunker to start shooting at him. And he told me that during that firefight with him and the enemy bunker, bark from the tree, they were really chewing up the tree he was hiding behind. He's probably one of the smallest people, the only people that could have hid behind a tree that small, that a lot of the debris was getting in his eyes. You know, there's a million things that happen in a firefight that we don't think about, on top of debris getting in your eyes. And, you know, he just was having a lot of trouble seeing throughout that battle. But he was really proud of his guys. And, you know, he always talked about his men and, you know, how proud he was and that they also exposed themselves to danger. And, you know, they could have sat back, they could have pulled back, just waited for artillery. But I believe there was, you know, a certain cadence. There was a certain time that they had to continue to move forward, you know, to protect other platoons. And he was able to get the mission done, and his men.
Yeah, you know, I was in that area for 2.5 years, so it amazes me that he was 4'9", which is shorter than most of the Vietnamese who are short people. I wonder what they really thought of him as a soldier. I bet they didn't give him the respect he deserved, I can tell you that.
You know, there's so many people, you know, I have a Facebook page for Richard, and so many people, you know, that didn't know I wrote the book or anything that popped up and said, hey, I was in Vietnam with him, I was in OCS, I was in this. And there's an ongoing theme. You know, there was a guy really recently that talked about training during airborne school, about a private walking up to Flaherty's platoon while they were training, and he didn't know Flaherty was a second lieutenant at the time, and he just walked up to him and said, hey, man, how tall are you? And Flaherty said, 4'9". And the guy, and he said, why do you ask, soldier? And the guy's like, well, you look funny, you know? And at that point in time, as an officer, Flaherty really could have laid into him and Flaherty kind of just deflected and said, you know, well, you know, I'm not small, I'm unique. So, you know, he had a different take. Flaherty, he wanted to win the people over, not, you know, use his stripes and his bars to you know, dominate people. And I think that's the right way to do it when you're working with other men. And everyone, look, I think Flaherty understood it. Everyone, it took days for people, you know, when he first got sent to the 101st as a platoon leader, a lot of the guys said, man, we were in shock. We just, like, we couldn't believe he's our platoon leader. He's in the military. And Flaherty would actually give people a few days to adjust. Now, once he gave you that few days and you didn't show him the respect, then he was going to lay into you, and he wasn't going to put up with any of it. But he did give people a little bit of time to get used to it, because he understood it's just such a bizarre thing to see somebody that small out there. But after he gave you that little grace period where you want to get one or two shots in or jokes, that's it ended. I'm an officer. You know, the other thing is people ask about, you know, was he a tunnel rat? As far as that mostly with the 101st and as a platoon leader, for the most part, I was told he never went into a tunnel, because as an officer, he was responsible for his men, and he didn't just go off into a tunnel and let the guys just hang out. So I don't believe he went into any tunnels, but he was as a recon platoon leader. There was one or two times where he did go in when he was with a small group of men of maybe 8 or 10 men out in the field, obviously with his size. So it's not like it never happened, but people immediately assume, hey, wow, great tunnel rat. And, you know, you're taking away from the fact the man was an officer and he earned his, you know, his bars. But yeah, people were really shocked, you know, to first see him, and I think he eventually won everyone over with his work ethic, with his lead from the front style.
Yeah, I researched his story, and I have a lot of photos of him in uniform and civilian life. To me, all the people around him, all his soldiers, all his fellow officers, they look like they were proud of the guy. I mean, the smile on their face was not out of making fun of him or anything else. They were very proud of Captain Flaherty. Would you agree with that?
100%. You know, all my interviews of all those guys, it's all the same. You know, when you realize a guy is squared away and a guy knows what he's doing, I mean, in the end, all a soldier wants to do is complete his mission and go home safely. So if you think you found that, you know, lieutenant, and I wasn't in the military, but, you know, I do enough reading on history about how dangerous it was for those guys in Vietnam to get a fresh lieutenant that doesn't know anything. That's not the case with Flaherty. When Flaherty got out to Vietnam in December, he listened to his sergeants. He listened to the guys out in the field with experience. There was no, hey, I'm fresh out of OCS school, I know what I'm doing. you know, Flaherty had confidence, but he trusted his men too. Which I think makes people really respect him as a leader. And the fact that he would put himself in danger, and the fact that he would carry as much a pack or more, and, you know, for some reason Flaherty also always carried the M72 Law with him. That was just his thing. So, proficiency in the field, I think, wins respect from men. And then that goes from, law enforcement background, too. You know, in law enforcement, my sergeant, my lieutenants, you know what you're doing. You care about your men. I don't care what color. I don't care what religion. I don't care if you're a guy, you're a girl. You care about me. You know, this. I'll be honest. When I first went into police work, I was a little unsure if women can get the job done as a fellow police officer. So what happens when I run into a fight and, you know, I'm with a small woman officer? Is she going to be able to do the job? And here's my answer. I've been in many fights as a police officer where some of the biggest guys were afraid to get their hands dirty, and some of the smallest females, they couldn't do much in the fight, but they were there with me. They were grabbing ankles and biting ankles and doing whatever they could. And that gave me a lot of respect. And you never know a person's heart. You can never judge a book by its cover. And you can never assume something just by the way someone looks. And, you know, taught me a lesson. And, not saying every female cop was the greatest, and certainly not every male cop was the greatest, but it certainly changed my opinion on people. That never judge a book by its cover, because it's the heart. Matter of fact, what could be more brave than a 90-pound woman jumping into a fight with me? I'm, you know, fighting a big subject, and she's getting tossed around and thrown around, or whatever it is. It's brave.
Wow, that's quite a story. All right, he left Vietnam and went to Green Beret training. How did that happen? And tell us a little bit about that.
So he started out with the 3rd Special Forces Group, and once again, he actually needed another waiver. You know, he had to keep getting these waivers. He needed a second waiver for Officer Candidate School, and then he did need another waiver for Special Forces School. I'm not 100% expert on... But I think, you know, Richard was trying to explain to me the story, and remember, I had to write it down in pieces, that when he went to Special Forces School, he was qualified as a Green Beret, but he eventually came back to the States, and he went to Fort Devens for what a Green Beret, I guess it's a Q course, to make them officially a Green Beret. And a real Green Beret can kind of explain to me. But that's something that Richard wanted to make sure he did, that even when he got back from Thailand and all these missions, that he went to Fort Devens. I think he was with the 10th group. But he went to Thailand, spent a year and a half in country, and that's kind of not many stories of what they were doing. I'm still researching. Trying to find out more information on the 46th Special Forces Company.
They were working behind the lines in Cambodia. I know that.
Yeah, you know, I did speak to John Stryker Meyer, an amazing human being. You know, he has a couple amazing books for your audience to please check out, too. An incredible hero. And I asked him about, you know, Richard and the 46th, and, you know, he told me that the only thing he knew was that they would use a lot of their pilots from the 46th, but he wasn't, you know, everybody was kind of encapsulated. You know, it was a need-to-know basis, you know, the 3rd Special Forces Group, what they were doing, and the 5th Special Forces Group. Not all those guys were aware of each other's missions, and probably for a good reason. So, there's a lot of stories that need to come out.
Absolutely. Being intelligence, I understand that statement. All right. I tell you what, David, when we come back from our last break, I want you to tell the folks about the young lady that he met in civilian life and fell in love, and then what you found out about his undercover work. I don't know if it's CIA, DIA, FBI. I'm not really sure. I don't know if you are too, but it is a remarkable story. Folks, we'll be right back. Please stay with us.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, join me, Roger B., every Tuesday at 1400 hours right here on America's Web Radio for the Locked and Loaded Show. We will talk about guns, weapons, ammo, gun accessories, prepping, and so much more. So be sure to join us every Tuesday at 1400 or 2 p.m. for Locked and Loaded on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
All right. Well, as with all American wars, when the soldiers come home after the war is wound down or we won it or lost it, the military's downsized. They cut the manpower. They cut the budget. And people have to leave the military or they have to be decommissioned. And that's what happened to Captain Flaherty. And he was really down in his spirits after that, very low in his spirits. But he did meet a young lady. David, take it from there. Tell us about his engagement and then get into his undercover work.
Well, like you said, the reduction in force, the RIF, was incredibly disappointing to Flaherty. His whole dream in life was to stay in the military, pass on the knowledge he learned in Vietnam to the younger guys. That was his only goal in life. When the RIF came, very disappointed. Like you said, he did meet an amazing young lady. They had a relationship for years, off and on. I'm not exactly sure, you know, the years that they had it. But in the end, Richard knew years before he passed that he was qualified to be buried in Arlington's National Cemetery. But instead, he purchased a plot in a small cemetery in West Virginia, in Milton, West Virginia, to be next to her. And I found some of the letters, and I found the letters of him purchasing the plot, and I spoke to the people at the cemetery, and they remember speaking to Mr. Flaherty, and his only goal was to be next to her. And I found the letter where he wrote the woman's sister about me. Like, his only goal is to be next to the woman he loved, for eternity. So I think, a lot of people think that Richard Flaherty was only about, I want to be a hero and I want my name on the statue. And I think where he chose to be buried as opposed to Arlington kind of shows that, he was a man and he loved deeply. And, he had more than just the military. So let's get into the undercover stuff.
His what fiance, we know is... Yeah, his fiance...
Well, he had... Yeah, when he initially got out of the military, he did get engaged, and his fiance was killed in a one-car accident. This isn't the same woman. That was his first fiance. This woman that he's buried next to is not her. Her name is Lisa Davis. He met her, Lisa. The woman he's buried next to, he met later in life. But yes, you want to talk about, tragedy after tragedy, getting ripped out of the military, starting a new life, and your fiance moves to Miami with your fiance, and she gets killed in a one-car accident. A lot of devastation for Richard. He had to overcome a lot of incredibly sad things. So
undercover.
The undercover work. So what we know is that he did go to South Africa. He was not in the Rhodesian military. Now, a lot of American soldiers, actually, I believe they signed into the Rhodesian military. He was just an advisor. He was there. I believe he was also in Angola. After there, Richard did hook up with a group of Green Berets. Now, they claim that they accidentally all just started working for the same car dealership, used car dealership in Miami, which is most ridiculous story, but that a bunch of former Green Berets all, you know, without knowing, all walked into the same dealership at the same time. So some of those guys started telling their stories. One of them told me a story that little group of those guys were even tasked with looking into what it would take to invade Grenada. And this was two years before the U.S. went into Grenada. So at that point in time, I think the U.S. was looking, you know, to do a little government change. After Grenada, the facts that I definitely know are Richard allegedly was contracted by the CIA to train anti-Castro or anti-communist rebels, Cuban rebels, in the Everglades of Florida. That is 100% that he was doing that. He was conducting that training. Who is behind paying for that training? You know, it's, you know, good luck trying to contact the CIA for them to say, yeah, we were paying Flaherty. But those missions were being tracked by the ATF. The ATF was well aware of Flaherty. They were tracking him. They were trying to bust it, you know, and I became really great friends with one of the agents, but I spoke to the initial agent that was tracking Flaherty. And, you know, and in his defense, he's like, we don't know who they're training or why they're training or what missions they're training. You can't just go in the middle of the Everglades and start training people with weapons. So, the ATF was really concerned with, you know, learning what was this all about. So every time they tried to grab Flaherty and his group, Flaherty's camp would move. So the agent, you know, admitted to me that the group was also, there was many law enforcement and even some federal law enforcement involved in that group that would just tip off the group before, you know, the ATF can get there. So, the agent was really, really frustrated. And he had a funny line when I talked to him. He said, man, the problem with dealing with special forces guys is they think they're special. So him and Flaherty didn't see eye to eye. Eventually, he grabbed Flaherty after Flaherty was coming out of the Everglades on a training mission with some silencers. But I guess apparently Flaherty was training these guys for an insertion into Cuba, obviously to take out Fidel. They grabbed Flaherty with some silencers, and they were going to charge him. And then Flaherty at the time was already a reserve Green Beret in Fort Bragg. And Flaherty didn't get along with that ATF agent. They just didn't get along. They didn't want to talk. And the other agent, who I ended up becoming friends with, this guy named Fred Gleffy, he overheard some of the arguments and the problems of Flaherty and not wanting to work with the ATF or give them any information. And Gleffy was an ex-CID man from the Army. And he went in there to talk to Flaherty, and immediately they had a great rapport. So once they had a friendship, Flaherty said, hey, you know, if you guys want to, you know, the ATF wants a real case, and, you know, you want to stop with this nonsense with me and the silencers, I can tell you about a bunch of guys who are stealing tons of weapons and explosives out of Fort Bragg and where they're going and into the black market. Now, that's, I got to say that with a caveat, because there are newspaper articles during that time that came out after this whole case that all claimed that was actually a CIA operation led by Captain Flaherty to get weapons down to Honduras and Nicaragua to once again fight communism. Now, you know, you'll see that throughout Flaherty's life, he devoted himself. His hatred of communism, Marxism, it was, you know, he would, wherever he felt there was communism in the world, he wanted to go there and pick up a gun and fight. So
we need that was, back.
I mean, that was Flaherty's thing. It didn't matter where. And the other thing about Flaherty was he understood when America sends its soldiers to, whether it's Vietnam or if we sent our soldiers to Central America to fight communism, we'd be spilling a lot of American blood. You know, as a Green Beret, he always believed in, you know, let the Nicaraguan people, let the Honduran people fight for their freedom. We'll go in there as Green Berets or as mercenaries, and we'll assist them and we'll provide them with training. But American kids shouldn't be going there bleeding in their jungle. That was something Flaherty really, really believed in, too, that you don't send the U.S. into Central America to get into wars in the jungles. You send your special forces to train, you know, an insurrection and you know, to train the locals to fight for their own freedom. So that ATF operation, which eventually ended with two Green Berets being arrested for selling explosives and weapons, you know, like I said, it's not without controversy. There were some, the CIA actually classified a few of those newspaper articles. They're unclassified now. People can look it up. They're there, you know, on the Internet, and make up your own decision of whether the ATF case was what, you know. You know, when I speak to Agent Gleppy, he says, listen, man, there was no CIA thing, at least not to any knowledge whatsoever with him. That this was a straight case of some Green Berets profiting off of taking, stealing weapons and explosives and selling them on the black market. He feels the case is pretty strong, and you know, and Gleppy is about as professional and honest as you can get. So, is there a chance that there could have been more to it? Of course. You know, we live in a world where not everything is one way. So, I think it could be a lot more.
Well, I think we need to clarify one thing. He was working to stop the flow of cocaine weapons in and out of Fort Bragg, but that was Fort Bragg, California, not Fort Bragg, North Carolina, right?
No, North Carolina. Yeah, that whole case went down in North Carolina, yeah.
Okay. My bad. All right.
Yeah, they actually made the arrest. They had one of the Green Berets. The operation lasted like 3 months, and one of the Green Berets in one of their biggest buys, where they were, I don't know, a couple $100,000 for a couple of tons of weapons and explosives. They made the big bust, and I think it was Vero Beach, Florida. Maybe it was 1981 or 1982. And there's newspaper articles everywhere. You'll find a million of them. I did speak to one of the Green Berets. Two of them allegedly got 40 years apiece, but neither guy served even close to that. And there's reasons why. People say because it was a CIA operation, those guys got sprang pretty early, and they were sent right back to Central America to work for the CIA. That's what some people say. But I spoke to one of the Green Berets, a guy named Byron Carlisle, and it was really the most uncomfortable conversation of my life. Because I had to cold call this guy and tell him who I was. And, you know, the first words out of his mouth were, Richard Flaherty ruined my life. And then I went to jail, and this whole thing was a CIA operation, and Richard was running it. And, yeah, you know, we were all trying to get those weapons down there. You know, so it was kind of a tough thing to hear. But you know, Byron Carlisle, he claimed his innocence, that this whole thing was a CIA operation. Like I said, Agent Gleffy has his own take on it. The federal prosecutors have their own take on it, of what the case really was about. And it's up to the public to kind of, you know, I ended up writing that book, and I made a documentary. I try to really just put the facts out there as best as I can, and then let people make their own decision on what they want to believe. And I think, you know, everybody has different views of things, and I didn't want to dominate the opinion on all the operations. Trying to think of something a little bit more of the.
Yeah, it sounds like to me that Flaherty was a 4'9" James Bond.
Yeah, I mean, so that's, you know, the whole homeless thing. Well, was he homeless because he's hiding off the grid and everything like that? So I don't know. You know, there's a funny story of a cop I work with that told me, you know, and this was completely years after, you know, I was working on this project in years. And he goes, man, I got the strangest Flaherty story. One day, you know, he knew Flaherty is just this little homeless guy. And he said, one day I saw Flaherty dressed really nice, walking in the street, walking with one of those attaché cases, you know, like you see in the movies. And I pulled up next to him and I said, hey, Richard, what are you doing? And he goes, well, I got to leave the country. I work for the CIA. And the, you know, the cop laughed. It was the funniest story he ever heard in his life. And Richard went about his way. But, you know, it's really, listen, it's life is stranger than movies or TV. And we just don't know.
What a patriot. I want to read you something. This is the last paragraph of the story that I wrote on Captain Flowery. I quote, "A man's height does not determine his manhood. His weight does not determine his courage or strength of character. Color does it, religion does it, race does it, nor does sexual preferences. In combat, all that matters is training and covering your buddy's six. A ton of antiquated brick walls of perception have tumbled in the past few years. Perhaps the giant killer broke a few of those time-worn bricks with his bare hands." You agree with that, David?
Amen to that, brother. Amen. We need to hear that. People need to believe in something in these times. Too much infighting, too much negativity. If a four-foot man, 97 pounds, who was told he could never do anything, who was told he would probably, you know, amount to nothing, if he could overcome so much with his will, what can we do as a country if we come together, if we put down all the fighting, and we have the bravery of Flaherty, and we believe more in the country than in ourselves, that, you know, it's ask not, you know, what the country can do for you, but what can you do for this country? This is the most amazing country in the world. God bless our vets. We have the most amazing vets. You know, in times when things
okay,
are
Pete,
too
gotta
good,
go.
Sometimes people don't appreciate. We live in the greatest country in the world. We have the greatest soldiers, the greatest law enforcement.
Gotta go, Pete.
You know, I want people to really be positive and inspired by Flaherty's story.
Yes, sir. And God bless you for writing this story. Thank you for your service as a police officer. Thank you for saving this man's life and his career. Folks, join us next week for another fascinating story. David Yurzik, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much
You're
for having me on.
You're listening to America's Web Radio.
Bye-bye.
On the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.